the crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we look at the police state and suppression of information in the United States. We'll check in with civil rights activist Carl Dix from Ferguson, Missouri. He'll give us an update from the ground after the police shooting of unarmed teenager Michael Brown. Peter Phillips and Diana Grant will tie in their recent study on police violence and militarization. At the bottom of the hour, we check in with Michael McCray of the Acorn 8, co-organizer of the recent Whistleblower Summit in Washington, D.C., and we finish today with a clip from Strike Debt Collective on credit reporting. Please stay with us. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. We begin today's program with updates from Ferguson, Missouri. Our first guest is longtime civil rights activist, co-founder of the Revolutionary Communist Party, Carl Dix. Carl Dix has been in Ferguson and was arrested there. And Carl Dix has a lot of things that he would like to share with listeners about race, police oppression, and the state of civil rights in the United States. Carl Dix, you are with us.
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on.
Carl Dix, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. It's been a little while, but you've had a harrowing week. Certainly the people of Ferguson, Missouri have. Can you tell us a little bit and tell our listeners a little bit about what you've been doing there and your arrest and aftermath?
I came down to Ferguson a week ago today, actually, and what brought me down was the police murder of Michael Brown, but even more than that, the way that people here stood up in the aftermath of that murder, refused to suffer it in silence, took to the streets demanding justice, and then in the face of everything the police threw at them, you know, like militarized weapons, armored personnel carriers, tear gas, rubber bullets, sound cannons, continued to stay in the streets demanding justice for Michael Brown. And I decided I had to come down here and stand with people and bring to them a message of the impact that their stand is having around the country and even beyond that worldwide, and to connect the struggle here into the larger struggle against police terror, mass incarceration, what I have characterized as a slow genocide targeting Black and Latino people. And it's been a harrowing week, but also a gratifying week, because pretty much wherever we go, people on the streets, people in the demonstrations, people in the jail here in St. Louis welcome the fact that people had come from other parts of the country to stand with them in this struggle.
Hey, Carl, it's Peter Phillips. Thanks for being on the show with us. Now, you got arrested Monday night.
Yes, I did.
And it seems that you might have been singled out in particular to be arrested. Tell us about what happened.
Yeah, what was happening was Monday was the day that they mobilized the National Guard. And it was pretty clear that this was another layer of intimidation being directed at the people here in Ferguson, another attempt to suppress their resistance, and that it pretty much came from the fear of the authorities, the fear that what people here in Ferguson were doing would infect people in other parts of the country who also faced the same kind of police terror and repression that people here were facing, and that this could inspire others to stand up. So we felt it was necessary to go out that night with a message of do not back down. Don't be intimidated by this. It reflects their fear of you, and you have to keep standing up because no justice had yet been achieved. You know, for all that people had done to raise the issue of police murder around the country and to show a shining example of resistance, the cop who murdered Michael Brown, Darryl Wilson, has still not been indicted. The police chief, Jackson, who has presided over decades of brutality and terror directed at black people here, still hasn't been fired, and he needs to be. And they were still carrying out an investigation that was essentially a cover-up. So we were basically raising, don't be intimidated, continue to stand up. And then some people who have appointed themselves and been accepted by the authorities as peacekeepers within the demonstrations took it upon themselves to attempt to shut us down. And that was both in terms of shouting us down. When that didn't work, they got physical. They tried to push us off the street. And one of them in particular, the alderman from St. Louis, Antonio French, punched one of my comrades while he was being held by several other people. So after that happened, we were on the side in the crowd, and about 10 to 12 police officers came up to the crowd, pointed out myself and Joey Johnson, and arrested the two of us. And as we were being dragged off, Captain Ron Johnson, the black state trooper who's been touted as the officer friendly of the forces that are, you know, maintaining order, pointed at each of us and said, these two get heavier charges. They don't just get off with failure to disperse, which was ironic since there was no order to disperse that was given. But the point was that everybody they arrested that night, they were going to give failure to disperse. And Captain Johnson was saying, I want to hit these guys with heavier charges.
So what have you been charged with?
We were released after spending much of the night in jail. And the way they do it here in Missouri is that your charges aren't finally determined until later. But the only charge that was there, the heavier charges have not yet materialized. The only charge that was written down was the failure to disperse. And we'll see if it stays at that level or these heavier charges come down later.
Carl Dix, in the United States, we know now that there's 600 to 700 annual shootings by police officers in the country where they kill somebody. There's another 800 to 900 prisoners who are in local and county jails that die usually within the first week of being incarcerated. So we're talking like 1,500 deaths, and it's almost inevitable that these are rule justified. And in this case, in Ferguson, it certainly seems that maybe we'll see an unjustified death. And many times families are suing the police departments and winning money, but it's never found that the police are wrong, certainly not by themselves. So how do you see this overall in the country? Or do we have an epidemic of police killings?
Yes, in fact, back in 1996, when we formed the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality, part of the reason for that is that we saw a nationwide epidemic of police brutality and police murder, which has intensified since then, because your numbers are right on, are accurate. And it really is the case that cops are virtually never punished for any of this. I was interviewing with somebody today, and she asked me, do I remember cops being convicted? And I could only think of three cases in the last two decades where cops have been convicted. And this is even when the evidence is right there in front of you. Like just recently in Rikers Island, there was a case where cops took two prisoners, shackled them to gurneys, rolled them into a room, and just beat them senseless. Their blood was splattered all over the walls of the room afterwards. And there was a video running. So all of this was caught on video. But despite the fact that these prisoners were shackled when they were wheeled into the room and the guards were clearly carrying out a revenge beating on these people, the DA decided there was not enough evidence to indict. You know, and there it was right in front of him, the evidence, the fact that the prisoners were doing nothing to deserve it. And that is the norm. What makes Michael Brown's murder not the norm is the response of the people to it. And that's very, very important. And that's why we can't leave people alone in this struggle. In fact, the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, or a couple of us who work in the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, issued a call for people to come to Ferguson to stand with people in this fight for justice for Michael Brown and to bring to it the sense of a nationwide movement of resistance to police terror and mass incarceration.
Even the case of Obama saying we've got to, maybe we've gone too far with the militarization of the police and arming them with weapons of war. But, you know, Ferguson gets treated as if it's an isolated case. Maybe there's a rogue officer there. Maybe he will get indicted. That's still TBA. But it's not talked about in this broader context of the October 22nd movement, the coalition, which has been around for almost a decade now. Certainly, that's a very important piece of understanding in a broader way. Project Censored sponsored a research study back in 1998 with Karen Sari, a member of the October 22nd Coalition, where she read the newspapers for that year and found that there were over 694 deaths where law enforcement was present. And that was twice as many as the criminal justice records had indicated. So we know that this is a severe problem. It's kind of an ongoing situation that we have talked about for quite a while.
Yes, it is. And what it comes down to is, that's why I call it a slow genocide, because it is part and parcel of an overall program of criminalization and demonization, especially of Black and Latino youth, who are people that this system really has no use for. The jobs that their previous generations worked in the factories have disappeared because production's been globalized and they can make higher rates of profit by working people in Thailand, Mexico, and other places in much more dangerous conditions, paying them much less than people here in this country. That makes these young people surplus population. And then by demonizing and criminalizing them, they can put them under control because they remember the 1960s when young people of color rose up and rocked the system back on its heels. And what we are saying to people is that look at these horrors for what they are. Don't accept the stories about the criminalization, you know, because they're trying to paint Michael Brown as a criminal after the fact, you know, releasing a video of him supposedly shoplifting some cigars.
Which is not true, Carl Dix, right? That's untrue. And the police officer there, or the head of the police, tried to apply multiple red herring approaches to change the subject and to try to blame the victim. I mean, that's a common policy that we see, unfortunately. But you have a lot of experience with that. You mentioned the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. You're co-founder with Dr. Cornell West of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and you've worked a lot on Stop and Frisk. So, you know, you're a veteran to these types of issues. So seeing you in Ferguson really shouldn't be a surprise. But apparently somebody there must know your reputation precedes you.
Yeah, I mean, look, the talk about outside agitators that they've been hitting us with since Monday, one, it's an old charge. I mean, you go back to the 1960s, Bull Connor, the sheriff of Birmingham, who was infamous for sticking dogs and water hoses on Black children marching for equal rights, or George Wallace, one of the leaders of the segregationist movement, used the same charge to try to, you know, demonize protesters back in the early 1960s. And it's the same thing today. People who want to keep the status quo in effect want to make the conversation about outsiders who've come in and agitated people a violent element among the protesters. The real violence here is coming from the state apparatus.
And Carl Dix, you said upon being released from the St. Louis County Jail, quote, there are no outsiders in the struggle for justice and liberation.
Yes, I did say that, and that's real. Don't tell me about I'm outside this situation. I come from New York City, which means I don't live in Ferguson, but I do live police terror directed at oppressed communities. I live a life where Black men, Latino men, and increasingly women as well can be targeted by the police for any reason or for no reason at all. So you can't tell me I'm outside of this situation. It's the same situation, just in a different locality. And when people on the street hear that we came down from New York City and all like that, they welcome that. I mean, people want to hug me when they hear I came down from New York City.
Carl Dixon, the media has, of course, the corporate media has distorted this issue greatly. There was just another tragic shooting of a young man, 25-year-old Mr. Powell. Again, you know, the tragedies continue, and the rampant militarization of police that's gone on, particularly post 9/11, we're seeing these are almost like test cases in many ways to see what martial law looks like.
Yeah, I mean, because in fact, I was talking with someone today, and they were like, "Well, what's the point to this militarization of the police?" And there are two things to it. One is to deliver a message of intimidation. The other is to be ready and prepared for people rising up, because I think they're expecting these are going to be possible developments in the future. So they want to have a police force that can and will carry out the kinds of things that they call other countries' human rights violators for. Of course, when they do it, it's supposed to be justified because it's maintaining their order.
Well, we see the longstanding double standards. And, of course, the history of this is important. The National Guard at Kent State. I mean, again, when the National Guard comes out and when we see this overt militarization, we see it now in our domestic policing. It's definitely a clear sign. Project Censored covered these stories for quite some time. It is good to hear from you on the ground, Carl Dix, in Ferguson. We're going to change our focus to the militarization of police specifically, but thank you so much for joining us with an update.
Okay, let me give people a website where they can follow the development.
Sure,
on the ground.
Please do, Carl Dix.
That would be revcom.us. That's revcom.us. I also encourage people to go to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network website to find out about the October month of resistance that we're mobilizing, and that would be at stopmassincarceration.net.
Thank you so much, Carl Dix. We'll definitely be looking in those sites. We're going to turn our attention right now to a study that's in the next Project Censored book. It is in Censored 2015, Inspiring We the People. That'll be out this October. I put together with Andy Lee Roth and the Project Censored crew. Peter Phillips, my co-host, is also a sociologist, and we're in education. And Peter, along with Diana Grant and Greg Sewell, put together a study called Law Enforcement-Related Deaths in the United States, quote-unquote justified homicides, and their impacts on victims' families. And this ties into this militarization issue. And Peter, why don't you talk to us a little bit about this study, and you also have a clip that you put together with Diana Grant.
Well, certainly we've known now for 15 years, and we've been following this. When the October 22nd coalition emerged, we thought it would be important to research. According to FBI data, there's only 350 to 400 deaths on an average shooting. We're finding twice as many being reported in newspapers. So that was an important piece of what we did. So we asked Diana Grant, the co-author on this study, in an interview this week, why that's happening.
We're interviewing Professor Diana Grant from Sonoma State University. She's a professor of criminal justice, and she was a co-author of the study we did on law enforcement-related deaths. It will be published in the Censored 2015 yearbook. Diana, you focused on some of the difficulties of trying to determine actually how many people are dying in law enforcement-related deaths. What records do we have, and what public information is there?
The public information is not nearly as thorough as you would expect it to be, given that we make statistics about everything. So we have arrest-related deaths, which is a very useful database, but is imprecise because it includes people who may have committed suicide when police come there and a number of other things. So we do not have consistent, regularly gathered annual data on the number of deaths that occur at the hands of police.
Doesn't the FBI actually list numbers of police shootings in some of their databases?
It does list numbers of police shootings in one of their databases, but that doesn't come out annually, and so it's an intermittent resource.
So the most recent data that you found for our study was how many years? It was a couple of years old, correct?
Was a couple of years old.
So we don't always know. And those are self-reported shootings, right? So the police department ends up shooting someone who dies, then they may report it to the FBI, but is it mandatory?
It's not mandatory, and there's, for example, when we were looking at some of the statistics, New York had some technical glitches in its database and just simply did not report for part of one whole year. So the database has holes in it, and it is voluntary reporting to the FBI. So, again, we don't have a complete picture.
So we did newspaper reviews, and we found that 600 or 700 people a year were dying in law enforcement-related deaths. Most of those people were shot by police officers. But you're saying that there's no government statistics that really give us that data accurately.
There's no consistent government statistics. The FBI statistics and the arrest-related deaths are the closest we get. But again, they don't cover every year, and they do not cover all jurisdictions. And in the case of arrest-related deaths, they conflate deaths from different issues.
So the shooting in Ferguson made a lot of attention because, you know, it was a rather horrendous murder. Do you think that there's a level of public awareness now that's increased because of Oscar Grant and because of Andy Lopez and the new shootings in Ferguson?
I think there's definitely an increase in public awareness. And what I would hope to see, but I have no idea if this will happen, is if we could get some national survey data from something like Gallup, if they would add that to one of their surveys. I would bet dollars to donuts that they would find much greater public awareness of these issues.
Well, that's really important, I think, to take a look at. So what I'm hearing you say is that the government doesn't really want people to know, or they're certainly not keeping records that would inform us up to how many people are dying because of law enforcement-related deaths. And these aren't just shootings, but these can be somebody being chased by police and they end up running their car into a telephone pole and dying.
Or chokeholds or something, as we saw in the New York case of the man who died at the hands of police.
Or taser deaths.
Or taser deaths, which are very hard to track. It just seems very ironic. I think I would have to agree with that. It seems very ironic that if you look at the Bureau of Justice Statistics, they have very comprehensive data on so many aspects of the criminal justice system. Sometimes I joke to my students in research methods that you could probably tell how many cruisers they ordered in Omaha and look it up in the BJS, you know, how many new cruisers or computers.
But not how many people.
But not how many people have died.
Wow. Okay.
And so it's not that we can't gather the data. We have the ability. Deaths are easier to track than other kinds of things, but we don't seem to have the political will to do that.
Well, Diana, thank you very much for taking time out to inform us on this, and thank you for contributing to the research that will be out in the Censored 2015 yearbook.
Thank you, Peter.
That was the voice of Diana Grant, who's a professor of criminal justice at Sonoma State University. The study that's going to come out, we researched the social science literature on policing, and one of the pieces that was quite clear was that research on police officers has noted that negative attitudes that police hold towards citizens as a part of us versus them outlook. Officers generally not trusted and have been suspicious of the citizens they police. In addition, officers historically do not believe that those outside the police profession can assist them in performing their duties. And even if outsiders did try to assist, they would not be of any real help. So there's certainly some attitude things and culture that's going on inside police departments. Our research team interviewed 14 families who had lost a loved one in a law enforcement-related death in Northern California between 2000 and 2010. All 14 of these families strongly believed that the police had overreacted and their loved one should not have been killed under the circumstances. Case number 2 was a black male, age 19, high school senior. This happened in Hayward, where he was shot in the back of the head while running away from a Bay Area Rapid Transit police. He had no record of mental illness and there were no weapons present. His mother said, the police and media said that the officer felt threatened by my son and they had to shoot him. Very few newspapers changed their story or apologized when they found out my son was shot in the back of the head.
That's pretty riveting information that you have out of this study, Peter, particularly, and of course, folks are well aware of the BART cops and the tragic Oscar Grant shooting, certainly more shootings in the Bay Area, Officer Gelhaus and Andy Lopez in Santa Rosa. And in each of these cases, there's really very little recourse. Even in the case of Johannes Messerly in the Oscar Grant shooting, he did very, very little jail time and very little repercussion in terms of how the law enforcement officers are treated. They basically can do these types of things with impunity. And in your study with Diana Grant, you're also showing that not only do they do it with impunity, but they terrorize and intimidate victims, families, the community, and the media tend to take the establishment narrative side.
And the victims are generally demonized both by the press and the police departments. So we actually asked the families to describe their loved one who died. And, I mean, there's a whole list of descriptions: artistic, loving, warm, compassionate, creative, friendly, happy-go-lucky. I mean, these were real people. And most of the families complained the police lied to them after the death of their family member, and the media would back up the police. So there's some very clear descriptions there. One witness said, after the incident, we were put in a patrol car. No shoes. My husband was still in pajamas. Seemed like hours before they took him out of the house in an ambulance. They wouldn't tell us if he was alive or dead. We were taken to the police office, told not to speak to each other. At 3 a.m., the police came and told us he had passed away. So there was a lot of complaining. All of the 14 families said that they were really abused, isolated, lied to by the police, and that's after the death of one of their loved ones. So these are pretty serious charges. We've documented this quite thoroughly. This study will be out in the Censored 2015 yearbook. We'll be posting parts of this online very soon at projectcensored.org.
That's right, Peter. You're working up an op-ed that pulls pieces out of the study that will be on the Project Censored website. So we urge listeners to go to the projectcensored.org website. If you are interested in the study, you can always go there and check out when the release for Censored 2015, Inspiring We the People, will be. It'll be out in October, so you can see the full study then. That wraps up this segment of the show, where we were looking at the events in Ferguson, Missouri. We had on Carl Dix. Peter Phillips was interviewing Professor Diana Grant. And again, we urge you to go to the projectcensored.org website for more information. After this musical break, we'll be back and we will be getting an update on the National Whistleblower Summit with organizer Michael McRae. Please stay with us. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Next segment of the program, we are going to be joined by one of the co-organizers of the National Whistleblower Summit that was in Washington, D.C. the last week of July. I was there with Project Censored Associate Director Dr. Andy Lee Roth. Project Censored was, in fact, awarded with the Pillar Award for Persons of Conscience in New Media and Journalism. While there, we met with, obviously, many of the organizers, people from the Government Accountability Project and so forth, and we're joined now by one of the co-organizers, Michael McCray. Michael McCray is an attorney, also an author with Marcel Reed of a book called Race, Power, and Politics, Memoirs of an Acorn Whistleblower. So Michael McCray himself is a whistleblower and has been a longtime whistleblowing activist. He joins us by phone. Michael, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule. I know we were trying to get you on last week, but you had to put us on hold because you had a meeting with Bill Clinton. So we forgave you with that for having that meeting, and are happy that you're joining us today, Michael.
Well, Mickey, I'm sure you forgave me that one time, so I've used my mulligan.
Indeed. Michael McCray, tell us about this whistleblower summit. But it was co-sponsored by Code Pink, Pacifica Radio, etc., many other organizations, but it didn't get a lot of attention in the media, so even here at Pacifica. So we wanted to have some people back on here, and you certainly were at the top of the list. We had Marcel Reed on prior to the summit, and now we have you on for an update. So tell people a little bit about this summit, maybe its origins and some things that have happened.
It's the Whistleblower Summit for Civil and Human Rights. And essentially, it's a continuation of a series of conferences that whistleblowers have had in Washington, D.C. and across the country, starting back almost 8 years ago in 2007. And so the Make It Safe campaign or coalition is a group of a couple hundred NGOs, non-governmental organizations, nonprofit organizations, labor unions, individual whistleblowers, whistleblower advocates, activists. You know, it's kind of a community of whistleblowers. And that's one of the things that I really want to talk about, because when most people think about whistleblowers, they think of individuals. You know, they think of Aaron Brockovich. They think of Frank Serpico. And that's what's always portrayed in Hollywood. And so part of the reason that I got involved with the Make It Safe campaign is that after I blew the whistle on USDA for $40 million of waste, fraud, and abuse back in the 1990s, you know, what happens to you, you face severe retaliation, and isolation is the number one tactic used against whistleblowers. And so you really need to seek out a sense of community, and that's kind of what the Make It Safe campaign and those coalition members are. And they kind of became kind of an extended family to me. Like most families, sometimes it's dysfunctional and you got the crazy uncles. But it became a place where I could go and be among colleagues and friends that would kind of understand what I was going through. And so that's why I started to get involved with, back then it was called Washington Whistleblowers Week. And I started to work with, at that point in time, I was working with the No Fear Coalition and some of the other NGOs. Over time, what happened is we wound up having different groups would host the conference every year. And so the first year, it was basically the entire coalition to Make It Safe campaign. The next year, No Fear hosted the conference. I think for the next 2 years, it was GAP, the Government Accountability Project. Fifth year, the year after that, it was the IAW, the International Association of Whistleblowers, which I'm one of the co-founders of that organization. And then, I guess like the last three or four years, the remaining years, what has happened is the Acorn 8 became the host. And what we did was we have rotating co-hosts. And Mickey, the reason that we did it is that we really want to share the conference. At some point in time, you know, the conferences are all excellent. You know, they've all been special in their own ways, but sometimes you wind up with a little infighting where one group doesn't get along with the other group. So we've been kind of peacemakers, and we're kind of like, you know, the Swiss. We're neutral. And so we try our very best to share the conference and share the summit with the other coalition members. So the first co-host was the USDA Coalition of Minority Employees. The next co-host was Federally Employed Women Legal Education Fund. And then this year, our co-host was Drum Majors for Truth, which is a group that's associated with Zena Crenshaw and the National Judicial Conduct and Disability Law Project out of Chicago. And yeah. So one of the things that's really special about our conference is that we've tried to broaden the concept of whistleblowing and the appeal to whistleblowers to people that don't normally get involved in those kind of First Amendment aspects. And essentially, that's where the innovation of tying whistleblowing to civil and human rights was really big for us. And when we did that, that's what allowed Pacific to become involved. That's what allowed Code Pink to become involved. That's what allowed Teaching for Change to become involved. And so what we've tried to do, a lot of, you know, for the first couple of years, it was kind of whistleblowers talking to each other. And what we've been trying to do is widen the tent and broaden the, really broaden our megaphone so that we can talk to other people, you know, such as Project Censored and other groups that you don't normally see getting involved in whistleblower aspects.
Michael McCray, hi, this is Peter Phillips. I'm really interested in what happens when a whistleblower or someone inside a bureaucracy, school district, government, corporation decides that what they're seeing, what they have knowledge of, is improper, that there's something wrong, and they speak out. Typically, the first response is the denial, then if they speak more, a denial by the corporation or the group. And then, of course, if they speak more, then there's an attempt to, in some way, discredit the individual, which seems to me a good reason to have whistleblowers banding together and supporting each other. Do you think that this is essentially correct, and where does it go from there?
Well, first off, Peter, congratulations on you for also winning the pillar. And I wish you'd been able to make it out to the conference and I could have met you in person. But, you know, you guys are doing great work. Mickey and Andy are great guys. And we're just so happy to be able to lift what you guys are doing at Project Censored up. And in answer to your question is, you know, essentially what we've discovered is that's basically a playbook. And it's what you just went down the litany of what tends to happen to almost every whistleblower that I know. You know, I think what was it? Gandhi says, you know, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, then you win. And in order to go through that process, it's you need a sense of community. And one of the things that what you have to remember is that when you're fighting any type of establishment, you know, they've got years and years of institutional knowledge. So, like, if you blow the whistle on the federal government, by the time you go through the administrative processes and you're in federal court, you know, it's the Justice Department that's actually fighting. And they've got all these briefs on files, and they have the collective knowledge of, you know, 100 years. Well, let's say 50 years at least of battling, especially like these civil rights cases and free speech case, and they are being paid by your tax dollar, you know, the federal government. And so what happens is in my case, if I'm fighting USDA, the bad guys, the managers, you know, they're not paying for their own attorneys, you know, and then at the end of the day, if I were to be blessed and to win, at the end of the day, the money's going to come from the judgment fund, which is, you know, funded at the Justice Department. And so, you know, it's not even going to come out of their pockets. So there's no incentive to settle. There's no incentive not to drag cases on for years and years and years. So all the economic incentives are basically designed to crush the individual whistleblower. And so kind of what happened to me was when I first got involved with the Washington Whistleblower Week, that was the first time I'd ever met somebody else who kind of knew, you know, what I was going through. And so, like, when I talk about this notorious bad judge that I had, his name was Thomas Pinfield Jackson, that I ever got a sense of acceptance. And so what happened is whistleblowers started to compare notes. They're like, oh, man, this judge, he's the hanging judge. You got to be careful for him. Oh, or that U.S. attorney, oh, she's very bad. You got to watch out for her. So what starts to happen is, one, it's a sense of community, and you get this mutual support network, but then also you get access to other who's a good lawyer who won't kind of take your money and screw you over? Or do you know any good therapists or mental health practitioners people that we can talk to? And so that's why, to me, the story of whistleblowers as a community, it really has never been told, or I've never seen it really in print. And so that's why, you know, we come together, we have conferences, we give, you know, we have sometimes GAP does, other organizations give CLE. They do these continuing legal education credit. You know, we have essentially lobby days where when we're trying to pass new legislation or the, you know, WPEA, which it took us, you know, took the community 13 years to get passed. We do all of these things. We have book signings. We have film screenings. We have, you know, lunches, the awards lunches, and solidarity dinners. And so I've never seen someone discuss whistleblowers as a community. And that's one of the things that's really special about the summit. And it's one of the reasons that I keep doing what I do.
We're speaking with Michael McCray, whistleblower, author, CPA attorney, one of the co-organizers of the Whistleblower Summit with Marcel Reed, the Acorn 8. You can learn more about the summit that just happened at whistleblowersummit.com. And those of you looking for other whistleblower sources, again, the summit was, I have to say, it was a fantastic opportunity to network with truth tellers. And at Project Censored, we've been highlighting whistleblowers over the years. Of course, most recently, from Chelsea Manning to Edward Snowden. Of course, Daniel Ellsberg is still very active in this area. But the interesting thing about the summit is there are so many people here that are not household names that have very important stories to tell. And a couple people that, you know, we were very happy to meet, Michael McRae, Stephen Cohn at the National Whistleblower Center. His book, The Whistleblower Handbook, A Step-by-Step Guide to Doing What's Right and Protecting Yourself. That's at whistleblowers.org, whistleblowers.org. Of course, meeting Tom Devine and Shauna and the great people over at the Government Accountability Project. That's whistleblower.org, singular. So there's an increase in awareness around the issue of whistleblowers, whistleblowing experience. And Michael McRae, you're sharing some things with our listeners, again, that maybe don't really come up a lot. Of course, some whistleblowers get no media attention. And when they do, sometimes we're missing the point about what these people are really doing. And one of the themes was that we hear in the corporate media that whistleblowers are selfish and they're self-interested. And our experience with whistleblowers is they're the opposite. They're selfless. They've put the interests of justice and honesty at large as a major issue, even if it's detrimental to themselves. Isn't that right, Michael McRae?
Oh, that is absolutely correct, Mickey. And one of the things that, you know, that we know as whistleblowers is, you know, the chance of winning a whistleblower case is, you know, it's less than 2%. I mean, if you're trying to do this out of, you know, for the money or the acclaim, you know, you got a better chance of winning the lottery. But most people really, they don't realize it. You'll see, every once in a while you hear about one high profile case, but by and large, you know, whistleblowers get decimated. It's a labor of love, or it's also reactionary. And the other point is that when you blow the whistle, and, you know, I didn't just blow the whistle. When I blew the whistle, my whole family blew the whistle. You know, my friends and my business associates, you know, they're associated with whistleblowers now. And so it's a much deeper and broader form of advocacy or thing that you're doing. So there's no, again, if there's any self-interest, if there's any victory at all, it's a pure victory at best. It's because it comes at much too high a price. Even some of the guys that I've known that may have made gotten a $1 million verdict. Yeah, they got $1 million but lost 30 years of their life. You know, so it's it really truly is a selfless act. Well, and I make you look. And let me also say one more thing. I want to give kudos to Pacifica. And as you start to talk about, you know, whether, you know, the ills, you guys talk about the ills of corporate media. The Pacifica Network, through our relationships with Marcel Reed, Marcel was able to get Pacifica was the first media organization to formally support whistleblower legislation and whistleblowers themselves. And so it truly is a special relationship that our community has with Pacifica, and really in terms of free speech, because that was the first, that was done, I think, 4 years ago. With the support, it was a unanimous board vote to support the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. And then they've been supporting the summit, the Whistleblower Summit, you know, for the last 4 years, ever since we started.
And the former executive director of Pacifica, Arlene Engelhardt, is an ardent supporter of the Whistleblower Summit.
Oh, and I thank you so much. I'd have been remiss for not mentioning Arlene. No, she's 100% in our corner. And she's been there since day one. She continues to advocate for us, you know, in front of the mic and behind the scenes. Arlene is great. And that's really important to have such an outlet where, you know, when we talk about, and I even have, you know, my show that comes on once in a blue moon, The Fifth State. You know, I deal with whistleblowers from a peer-to-peer level, as opposed to kind of like the, you know, putting whistleblowers under a microscope. And so, you know, it has a little different feel when I'm dealing with whistleblowers and talking to colleagues and other peers. But so, you know, hats off to Pacifica. Hats off to you guys. You know, we've got to put an end to this junk food news.
Thank you, Michael McRae. It was an honor to be with you in Washington. Certainly Project Censored honored to receive the Pillar Award. And we will definitely be catching up with you in the future. Learn more at whistleblowersummit.com. Michael McRae, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you, Mickey. And good meeting you too, Peter.
All right.
After this short musical break, we'll be right back with a clip from the Strike Debt Collective on credit reporting. Listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. The final segment today, we are going to hear from the Strike Debt Collective at KPFA. Cassie Thornton and Mike Wilson did a report here on credit reporting industry, on the credit reporting industry and the pervasive effect it can have on people's lives. Here is that Strike Debt Collective report.
Imagine being tracked 24/7 by an invisible network, then classified and ranked according to a secret formula.
Imagine your file was full of inaccurate and discrediting information, yet it was being sold to critical decision makers and used to compute a numerical ranking called a credit score, which determined your ability to access the basic necessities of life, a roof over your head, basic utilities, even a job.
Imagine this number dropped every time someone looked at it.
Imagine that if this numerical ranking was low, you would have to pay more for things. But if it was high, you were allowed to pay less, sealing your fate in a financial caste system.
These are the basic dynamics of the system of surveillance and control known as consumer reporting.
So, Mike, how's your credit rating?
No comment.
That bad, huh?
The only thing I can think of to say is, I'm Mike.
And I'm Cassie. And this is Strike Debt.
When there's so many of us can't afford a home, when there's so many of us who can't get a job, man, I don't need your crumbs, I would rather starve. Strike debt, you are not alone. The American dream, it wasn't ours to own. The American dream, it has requirements. Your very blood, no lie, check the fine print.
Over 90% of the adult population is somehow entangled in the dragnet of credit reporting, yet few of us know precisely how. It's hard to keep track.
Consumer reporting agencies, otherwise known as CRAs, gather, organize, and standardize consumer data. Consumer data includes how we pay bills, how much money we owe, what our borrowing history is, where we work and live, where we have lived in the past, whether we've been sued, arrested, or filed for bankruptcy. This information about you is sold to creditors as well as employers, insurers, and increasingly to consumers themselves.
Yeah, and it's sold to landlords. I was recently looking for an apartment in the Bay Area, which is already impossible, and every landlord asked to see my credit report. Some of them asked me to pay $20 to $40 for them to get a PDF that represented me. I'm standing in front of them, but the only way I'm real is if they see my credit score. Over and over again, they judge me based on this PDF, rather than by my character, references, or rental history. I bet that the credit rating agencies even earned hundreds of dollars on behalf of my housing search. Money I could have put towards my first month's rent, or that the landlord could have put towards lowering the rent. What are they called again? Those credit ratings, so-and-sos? There's Equifax and...
The big three CRAs, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian, have long dominated the consumer reporting industry. Often labeled the national credit bureaus, they are actually global corporate conglomerates, which source labor and operate in markets around the world.
So they're not a part of the federal government. That's confusing, because CRAs play such a crucial role in our ability to access the most basic requirements of life in our society. A survey by the Society for Human Resource Management found that almost 60% of its member employers used credit reports to screen job applicants. That seems crazy.
Well, it is legal in 42 states to check someone's credit report before hiring them. Credit scores also frequently factor in auto insurance rates. Approximately 92% of auto and home insurers rely on them, according to a survey in 2001.
Alarmingly, hospitals have begun using credit scores to determine access to health care and to set costs.
Today, we'll guide you through the consumer reporting matrix, but also question many of its basic assumptions and standard operating procedures.
Decades of industry surveillance and control, often with government assistance or approval, have steadily transformed our culture, altering our values and behavior, and generally instilling financial obedience.
Today, credit scores are treated as a measure not just of our credit worthiness, but of our all-around personal integrity. Low scores virtually guarantee punishing credit terms and ruinous cycles of debt. And because someone won't have a credit score unless they use credit, it penalizes people who do not use credit products, like someone who wants to rent a car.
Hence, the credit reporting industry gives a boost to the widespread use of credit. People no longer have a choice of whether to use credit or not.
But even good behavior cannot guarantee high scores in our systemically flawed consumer reporting system. Financial surveillance is a corrupt and impersonal machine, not a system that genuinely determines people's trustworthiness.
Can't make a credit card payment because of health costs this month?
It's recorded.
Got laid off and couldn't pay tuition?
It's recorded.
Tried to pay a mortgage fee with an already low checking account balance?
It's recorded.
And if there is an error in your report, good luck with getting it corrected. The CRAs require you to jump through all kinds of hoops to get them to correct your report, and you have to make sure each of the three CRAs have the corrected information.
The fact that the credit reporting and scoring system is set up to maximize profits for corporations instead of helping consumers is leading more and more people to consider alternatives. Thus, in addition to suggestions for individual self-defense and collective harm reduction, Strike Debt is also here to offer ideas for moving outside or beyond it. Oh, and now it's time for a commercial break. Daughter.
Can I borrow the car tonight?
Well, let's go check your credit report, then we'll know if we can trust you.
But, Dad, what's a credit report?
Well, honey, it's a collection of numbers that determine your integrity. You have to get a credit card and use it in order to prove that you can be trusted. After you get a credit card, we'll log into one of the credit bureau websites and pay $30 to buy a PDF that will explain whether you are worthy of our car.
But, Dad, I'm right here, and you've known me for 17 years. Why don't you trust me because you know me?
Well, honey, long ago, people trusted each other by experience. But now we have Experian, which does that for us. And it's all in one PDF.
Dad, I wish there was an alternative. I just want to borrow the car to go to a movie. By the time I get a credit card approved and we print the PDF out and you have time to look at it, my friends are going to forget me. The movie won't even be in the theater anymore.
Stop saying that word. Alternative.
Alternative. Alternative. Alternative.
Did I hear someone say alternative? Strike Debt, in collusion with the Feminist Economics Department, is in the process of developing an alternative credit rating bureau where people, just like you, can come in and get an alternative credit report based on an in-person interview. Our credit reporters will design a unique document that represents you, like the real you, your personal story, based on who you are and what your references say about you. This official document can be used to replace or accompany your numerical credit report when applying for apartments, jobs, and other basic amenities.
If you'd like an alternative credit report, go to alternativecredit.tumblr.com.
Today, each of the big three CRAs has credit files on over 200 million adults and receives information from approximately 10,000 furnishers of data, including banks and finance companies. Every month, these furnishers report on over 1 billion consumer credit accounts and other types of accounts.
We said it before, and we'll say it again. This data is increasingly used to determine our access to the basic necessities of life. Landlords use credit reports and scores to screen rental applicants. Employers use credit reports and scores to screen job applicants.
Credit reports are based on credit files, information about you contained in the databases of the NCRAs. But what kind of information do they keep about me in there?
Credit files likely include identifying information such as name, current and former addresses, social security number, date of birth, and phone numbers.
The credit score definitely includes trade lines, which are accounts in a consumer's name reported by creditors, including type of credit, credit limit or loan amount, account balance, payment history, delinquencies, collections, and dates of activity.
Also, your credit report takes into account your public record information, including bankruptcies, judgments, and state and federal tax liens.
They also look at third-party collections by debt buyers or collection agencies.
And the report includes inquiries in the last 2 years for employment-related uses and for at least the last year for credit uses and most non-employment uses. This includes tenant screening, insurance, and government benefits.
So, what don't they include in your credit report?
Examples of important information not contained in credit files include income or asset data, interest rates on credit cards, records of arrests and convictions, marriage records, adoptions, and records of civil suits that have not resulted in judgments. But we should say that specialty CRAs, such as employment screening agencies, do include records of arrest.
What do we do? It feels like an impossible game that I can't win at.
I know. I feel the same way. With all this information in front of me, all I can say is reject the system. It is possible to live without a good credit score. If you can muster the time and energy to make some life changes, you can go totally off the grid. You can look at Chapter 11 in the new Debt Resistors Operations Manual, which is available as a free online PDF at strikedebt.org. Maybe we can give some recommendations we've collected for how to live without a good credit score?
Sure, that would be helpful. We can start with some basics. First, prepaid cell phones don't require a contract with a big company and a credit check.
For housing utilities, if you have roommates, you can ask them to put the accounts in their names. If you live alone, ask your relative or a friend. I do this.
Create your own credit report. Put together a portfolio showing that you're a trustworthy person. Reference letters, job history, life narrative. You can go to alternativecredit.tumblr.com if you want to work with someone on this.
You can also check listings for housing, cars, and other necessities that are informal and don't go through brokers or other formal agencies. Craigslist can be a great option, as well as community boards.
If you are able, you can also offer to put down larger deposits in lieu of a credit check.
Finally, and most importantly, please join us. Build networks of mutual support in your community so you can rely less on outside services.
Consider joining Strike Debt and be a part of a national debt resistance. If you are in the Bay Area, Google Strike Debt Bay Area to find our Tumblr, Twitter, and Facebook pages and to attend or help with our upcoming events.
I'm Cassie.
And I'm Mike, and thanks for listening to another edition of Strike Debt Radio.
When there's so many of us can't afford a home, when there's so many of us who can't get a job, man, I don't need your crumbs, I would rather starve.
You are tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Cassie Thornton and Mike Wilson and the Strike Debt Collective at KPFA for that report. Thank you to our producer Anthony Fest and Erica Bridgman at the controls. The Project Censored Show airs on close to 20 stations around the U.S. To learn more about how to get Project Censored Show at your community radio station, you can contact us through projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, where we can also see comments you might have or suggestions for our show. And we'd like again to thank all of you for joining us. Thanks to Carl Dix. Thanks to Michael McCray. And we will see you next time for a show with Kevin Gostola from Ferguson, Missouri. Nafis Ahmed will be here talking about his new book and his new series on Pentagon data mining and targeting of activists. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fought for little boys in the